People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A Victoria organization supporting sex workers has a pilot program to help those who don't have a strong grasp of the English language. Peers Victoria Resources Society has been around since 1995. The new program is just one of many efforts to support the safety and well-being of sex workers in the capital region. It helps those who speak Cantonese and Mandarin. I got in touch with the organization's executive director, as well as the person running the pilot program.
My name is Lee, my pronouns are she, her, and I'm the executive director of Peers Victoria Resources Society. I've been with the organization for, goodness, over 6 years now, and in this role for over three, and I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you so much for having us on, Joe.
Hi, my name is Ray Ray. I'm the community support coordinator for the immigrant and migrant sex worker, this community. And my pronouns is she, her. And also I work here for 1 year, so I'm pretty new compared with Lee. I'm also very happy to be here.
Well, thank you both very much for making some time to be here. Maybe before we dive into the program you've been helping out with specifically, Lee, could you tell me a bit about what does Peers do?
That's a big question to answer, Joe. I'll try to do it as succinctly as possible. Peers Victoria has been in operation since 1995. So we actually just celebrated our 30th year anniversary last year. We're a bi, for, and with organization for current and former sex workers. Basically, we're pretty grassroots, started out with being founded in 1995, and we've really evolved since then. We have a bunch of different programs that range from housing support to outreach to health. We have free counseling, just a bunch of different options to support current or former sex workers across Vancouver Island, although our primary focus, as some of our programs are physically limited to where we can physically deliver services, are what is known as Victoria on Esquimalt and Songhees lands. So I can go into depth about what programs we have to offer if you'd like that, or I could just try to bullet point it for you. Not sure.
Well, maybe a good way into that is, what are some of the things that sex workers in the area need help with?
That's a great question. So basically, sex workers in our area often can encounter stigma when accessing health and social support. So folks may not feel comfortable disclosing the work that they do, which can limit the sort of help that they're able to receive, or when they disclose the work that they do, they may experience stigma or discrimination from healthcare or social service supports. So it sort of limits them. So one thing that we do see is a lot of the people that come into our organization for support often don't access other health and social service supports. So we kind of are a bit of a catch-all to be able to provide those avenues for folks. So like I mentioned, we do have health services. We have a street outreach nurse that is at our organization, as well as in a lot of our outreach programs. We do offer free counseling. We can help folks find housing as well as maintain housing if they're experiencing eviction. We do harm reduction work as well. So we have a night outreach van that goes to two different areas of the stroll where sex workers work. And we provide harm reduction in the form of condoms, lube, safer substance use supplies. So like, needles, pipes, etc. We also provide gear for when people are experiencing cold weather, tents, food, a hot meal. So we're sometimes like the only organization people will encounter that day, or the only hot meal that they'll have. So in terms of what support sex workers need, there's a huge range depending of what other intersections folks experience. If they're unhoused, if they're substance users, if they're working indoors, for example, going to school or whatnot, then maybe the supports that they're looking for with us is just community, like finding other folks that are doing the work that they're doing and have a safe, open place to talk about that. Or perhaps it's violence prevention support, so accessing our bad date and aggressor report. So sex workers have a way of keeping each other safe by letting each other know if they've had a bad date. A bad date can range from anything from someone refusing to pay to aggravated assault and everything in between. So we kind of circulate this report to sex workers across Vancouver Island so that they're aware of people to avoid And then people feel empowered by being able to share their stories and help keep their own community safe as well. So in terms of what support looks like for sex workers, we're very person-centered. We meet people where they're at. And that can look like a wide range of things, whether that's just coming in for a community meal or whether that's going out and speaking with their landlord and advocating for them to be able to keep their housing.
And Ray Ray, I understand that there's a growing population of people doing this work in the Victoria region who don't speak English. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. And also because of the language barriers, this community, they are hard to access health resources and also social resources. So that's why we have this kind of new program in Peers, because we want to build the safe community for those population, because they cannot speak English very well. And sometimes they are immigration and they don't know like how to access the Canada's resources and information, so we can help them. Sometimes, for example, like in every Tuesday, we deliver health supplies for them, like free condoms, gloves, also lubes, to some harm reduction supplies for them. Also, we provide like culturally safe referrals for healthcare and also mental health support, including translation assistance. Like if they want to have some health test, they can come to Peers and I will accompany with them to translate the English. Yeah.
And if I could just add on to that, one other barrier that this population is experiencing is that sometimes they're here, they're temporary residents. So they may be here on a work visa or a student visa. And if that's the case, they're actually legally not allowed to engage in sex work in Canada, according to the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. So that can be a barrier for them as well in accessing support because they're afraid of being deported. So for example, like accessing safety resources, accessing safer sex supplies, accessing healthcare, and being able to also divulge with the work that they do. So being able to connect with us, we don't ask people what their status is. We don't inquire about those particular pieces. We just, again, give them the supplies that they need or the connections that they need. And they are able to come in and access healthcare supports without having a healthcare card, and can use a fake name and all those pieces.
Well, on that front, Lee, do you think there's anything else that's important for people to know about the legal framework that regulates sex work and how it impacts the people that you work with Peers?
Oh, Joe, don't get me started. that could be an entire conversation in itself. What I will say is that Peers is a member of the sex work, the Canadian Alliance for Sex Work Law Reform. We're currently involved in a constitutional challenge at this moment, actually, going to the Supreme Court of Canada to address the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, which essentially are the sex work laws in Canada, as well as this Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which has very racist laws towards immigrants doing sex work and in Canada. But essentially, the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act was set up after the Bedford trials. The Harper government set it up after those. That was successfully brought to the Supreme Court of Canada, Bedford versus Canada. They had a year to basically create new sex work laws. These were the laws that put in place. Essentially, it criminalizes everything about sex work except for sex work itself. So it's legal to do sex work, but it's not legal to buy. It's not legal to hire bodyguards, security, drivers, to work in an agency in terms of hiring like admin support. Advertising is illegal. So it actually creates more exploitation and violence for sex workers by not being able to have the resources to work safely. And it often prevents, it also creates more stigma for sex workers as well, because it's still this like criminalized industry, where, you know, it's often said, and like the defense about these laws is, well, it's legal to do it. So like, therefore, we're not discriminating against sex workers themselves. However, it makes the work incredibly difficult. And there's lots of research that you can look at, even locally on Vancouver Island, Cecilia Benoit from UVic, Anna Lee Lepp. They do a lot of academic research and research across Canada, sort of showing the increase in exploitation once PASIPA, our short form for the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, became law. So it is something that we are addressing at court. We do think that sex work is work, and people deserve to have safe working conditions to do that work, which includes hiring admin support, hiring drivers, being able to work together, being able to rent spaces, being able to advertise online and to clearly communicate with clients what services they're offering, and clients being able to communicate back without fearing arrest. So that, people will often not communicate because they're afraid that it might result in divulging too much information, that resulting in them being charged.
Now, Ray Ray, when you're working with people who are engaging in sex work and they don't speak English very well, how do you connect in the first place, and what is that like?
First, I will send them cold text. So I will search them online, and if I find oh, maybe this a number I can connect with, I will send them cold text to introduce how does peer works and what kind of things, supplies, health, resources we can provide for them. And some of them choose to believe us and try to you like access our resources, and some of us maybe think we are like a spam, kind of spam. So it's hard to build the trust with them first. So I think it takes time for us, like for almost 1 year. Like maybe we can have some client just for 12 or 20. It's very hard to have the client in this community. And also build trust is very hard.
Well, what have you seen the impact of your work be when you have been able to connect with people? What have you seen? What kind of a difference have you felt like you've been able to make?
I think the most important things is like build a community, because first, as an immigration, maybe they are social isolated for this society, but we can build the community for them. And for example, we will organize some event every month for immigration sex worker, and they can they can join us, and they can make friends and talk about some things with each other, communicate with each other. I think this very meaningful, because these kind of things, what we do, give them some love and also warmth for them when they feel lonely in the new society or new country. So I think this is the most important things.
Is there anything that you're aware of that might be kind of driving the change of if there's a growing population of people who aren't speaking English who are doing sex work in Victoria, what might be behind that?
So I can speak to that anecdotally, but I don't have actual evidence to support that. So if that's okay, I will say, anecdotally, during the pandemic, we definitely noticed an uptick in folks moving from Vancouver, who maybe are who are immigrants or migrants and who primarily don't speak English, and doing work. So this is a gap we actually had identified, probably about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. And we had a couple folks come into our center at Peers who didn't speak English, and we did our best to support them. But at that moment, we kind of realized, ooh, we have a gap here. As well, we do partner or work alongside Swan Vancouver in Vancouver. They're a wonderful organization that specifically support immigrant and migrant sex workers of Asian descent. And they actually noticed as well that there are folks moving to Vancouver Island and sort of flagged that for us. And we're helpful in sort of being able to communicate with folks who are wanting to access service, and then they would come in and pick up things from us. And we were sort of working alongside Swan with them being able to utilize their language skills that they have and their ability to connect with this community. And it sort of just made us realize that there is a growing need on Vancouver Island. We are not like Vancouver in the sense that we don't have a bunch of different sex worker organizations that can support different populations. We are the only sex worker organization on Vancouver Island. So we wanted to make sure that we just are minimizing as many barriers as possible to access, and trying to support as many folks doing the work on Vancouver Island that we can.
Well, if an organization like yours didn't exist and there was just no one doing that work, what kinds of risks would people be facing, particularly maybe people in this situation who don't necessarily speak English?
I think broadly, if this organization didn't exist, what I will say is that sex workers experience higher rates of violence compared to other demographics. And that's primarily because of stigma and because folks feel like they can target sex workers and that they won't speak out about it. Sex workers are also less likely to disclose or to go to authorities if they do experience violence because of stigma and discrimination. So I think the important work that we do at Peers is decreasing violence and exploitation for sex workers by A, circulating the bad date and aggressor reporting sheet and using that community-based resource to keep sex workers safe, but then also being able to provide basic needs support such as food, clothing, shelter, etc., to be able to like help people perhaps choose less, like to not have to choose dates that are maybe going to put them at risk, for example. But also just that community connection. I feel like community is so important in terms of preventing isolation, and that is in itself a huge piece of harm reduction. Isolation can exasperate as well as cause many different mental illnesses. Being able to keep each other informed and educate one another and create that community connection where people can be honest about a huge part of their life is so important. And I think that also connects with Ray Ray's program. I think that we have a lot of different groups at Peers that specifically look at different intersections. So we have a group for Indigenous sex workers. We have a group for queer mask sex workers. We have a group for trans, non-binary, two-spirit sex workers. And for Ray Ray's program, it is a unique context that immigrant and migrant non-English speaking folks face with sex work. It is a different sort of clientele that they're maybe experiencing. There are different barriers that they're experiencing. So being able to create community connection around that, to be able to discuss those barriers and address them together. And again, community-led decision-making is what sort of defines our organization. So learning from them and being able to lead our programming based on the feedback that we're receiving from them is incredibly important. Not having our organization on the island, I think that there would be a lot of people not accessing service, not accessing medical service, not accessing violence prevention service, and perhaps more folks just like falling through the cracks. Because as I've mentioned, we are sometimes the only organization that people see because they're the only ones that they feel safe seeing. And I think that especially for Ray Ray's program is true. Like a lot of these folks weren't accessing any health or social service supports from a myriad of different reasons. And I'll pass it to Ray Ray actually to follow up on that.
Thank you, Lee. And I think the risk for my program, non-speak English program, I think the risk is, like as Lee mentioned before, is identity, because most of them just have visa. They are not citizen or they don't get the permanent residence in Canada. So, and also because of their own culture, like it's total different things based on Canadian law and other countries' law, and they don't know like how they can protect them when they meet dangers, when they do their business. So I think the Peers is kind of bridge to provide this resources and information for them to let them know how you can protect yourself. Like they can give me the bad date report and we will connect. It's like a bridge to connect other like resources, and for them they can just be very safe, and they don't worry about use their real name. They can just use their fake name when they access to our resources, and I think that's the risk they have.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Lee and Ray Ray of Peers Victoria Resources Society, an organization that provides support to sex workers in Victoria. We're talking in part about a program they offer providing outreach support to immigrant and migrant sex workers in the capital region. We're talking about a program that's covering like the intersection between people engaging in sex work and people who are maybe of precarious immigration status or don't speak English very well. I'm wondering, for this program is focused on health and like the determinants of health, especially things like housing, things like poverty, things like substance use. Lee, maybe could you tell me about what you see in your work about the intersection maybe between sex work and some of those other determinants of health, and what you think people need to know on that topic?
Yes. Well, I think that there's a lot of misunderstandings of sex work in the general public sphere. I think when we look at media, sex work is depicted a certain way. So I think that people think of it as street-based work. They think of it as the most precarious, as people being forced into these types of situations. I will say that like sex work is a huge spectrum. We encounter folks who, you know, are only working online, who are only working indoors, and then we encounter the opposite. What I will say is, sex work is a spectrum. The majority of sex workers, I would say, are not actually in that small precarity of work of being street-based and working outside. However, the majority of the folks that we support are. And that's because they're coming to us for those pieces that you mentioned around the social determinants of health. Like, they are looking to meet their basic needs. They are looking for support around housing. We do see a lot of intersections when it comes to that. I think when you think about mental health, especially, you know, just in the context of, you know, what is known as Canada right now, there is, you know, we are living through a toxic drug crisis. We are living through a time where there is a huge rise in folks that are unhoused or precariously housed in this country. So we do see a lot of those intersections. And, you know, in sex work on Vancouver Island as well, we also see a disproportionate amount of those sex workers being Indigenous. So, like, you know, So we do see sort of like the impacts on certain communities we see that in the unhoused community, as well as folks who use substances that we support as well. Like, there is impacts of colonialism that we are seeing on these populations as well. So it's a very complex issue. As I will say again, sex work is a big spectrum of work, and the majority of folks are doing quite well and working indoors, and it's not what you're going to see on TV. However, because of what we do in the organization that we are, and meeting people where they're at physically, and that means like going and doing outreach outside, we definitely do encounter folks sitting more at those intersections of, sex work, being unhoused, having mental health challenges, potentially being racialized. And then as well, the one last intersection I will mention is there was a Bias Forest report done across BC by and for sex workers that highlighted, I believe it was 74% of sex workers that were surveyed for that report identified as having a chronic illness or disability. And that is something that we do see at our organization as well, is it is a type of work that folks who are living with a disability are able to do because it's well-paying, and they can do it when they are able to work. And when they're not able to work, then perhaps they're stepping back and taking time off for a few weeks. It's also, you know, disability benefits in our country aren't always enough to let people get by. So then perhaps they're doing extra work on the side. But that is a big intersection of the industry as well, is folks living with a disability doing this work.
That Bias for Us survey you mentioned there, released in 2023, widely reported on at the time. And that seems like a really significant finding that I almost just think we need to pause on, that 74% of people who filled that out reported that they identified as having a chronic illness or disability. What do you think we should take away from that and do with that information?
That's a really good question, Joe. I think that there's multiple things to take away from that. I think that, first of all, I think there's a big movement around empowerment of bodies and and that being aligned with sex work as well. I think like sex positivity, body positivity. But I think that in a capitalist society, we have this ableist mindset that is also driven by this idea of labor. And then, so when we think of sex worker rights, which are tied to labor rights, we're also thinking about what's inherent to that is the idea of the body being able to contribute to labor in order to be a valuable resource in today's capitalist society. And I think that there's a lot of pushback about that in these political areas around disability justice. And I think that's really interesting when it intersects with sex work, of like being able to own your body and own your identity and be able to work outside the system to be able to provide for yourself, and an act of resilience in doing that. I also think it's a commentary on our social service support networks within our country, in the sense that what folks are receiving for their disability benefit is not enough. It's not enough to get by, especially when you consider higher costs of living, especially in this province. It just often is not enough for folks. And in order to be able to get by and in order to be able to put food on the table, they need to do something extra, and they're limited to what they can do. And I think this can be a really great avenue for people who are limited to what they can do, to be able to choose to make to work a couple days a month if that's all they have capacity for, and that provides just enough income for what they need. I don't want to speak too much on it because I think that I am not someone who is impacted by living with a disability, and or as negatively impacted as others might be. Like I'm still have a full time position. So I think it's them that should be speaking to perhaps like, like what this intersection really looks like and what we should be taking away from it. But those would be some like initial thoughts that I would have.
Well, if we're talking about just general health for people engaging in sex work, and maybe as well the specific population that Ray Ray you're working with, what parts of the situation do you both feel could be improved through more open public dialogue or further public awareness of some of these issues?
I think that there's a lot of things that could be improved. Public awareness and public education is something that we definitely try to do at Piers Victoria. And I think there's always more that we can do. Something that we're always trying to make people aware of, especially right now, is the harms of the current laws on sex workers. And so, for example, like being involved in that constitutional challenge, letting people know that people think, like even the title, the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, makes it seem like this is an act and a set of laws that are going to protect people. Letting people be aware that actually these laws are quite harmful and contributing to increased violence and exploitation. So that's one. Two, I would say probably the thing I encounter the most in my line of work is the conflation between human trafficking and sex work. And I think that is very pertinent to Ray Ray's program as well. When we think about immigrant and migrant sex workers, like this Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, which we mentioned, like these sex work prohibitions for folks that are coming here on a visa is to prevent them from being trafficked, right? Or that's what they're stating. But actually, they can be quite ineffective and actually prevent people who are experiencing exploitation from seeking help, because they then fear deportation. So I think that as well, in the general public, a lot of people think like sex workers are forced into this. That's a very precarious position, that it's inherently exploitative, and that all sex work is either trafficking or is likely to be exploitative. And what I just would say to those people is that sex work is not inherently exploitative. Exploitation can exist in the industry, but that's only when you have precarious working conditions or laws that perhaps make the public think that sex work is something that is like dirty or, it exists in this gray area or, in the shadow. So perpetrators can come out and exploit people. Just like any job, exploitation can exist if you don't have proper and safe working conditions. So I would say that there is a big difference between human trafficking and sex work. And just because exploitation can exist in sex work, just like it can exist in any other job, like serving or truck driving or whatever, it doesn't mean that the job itself is exploitative, and that we just have to work together to ensure that sex workers have access to safety and have access to resources, and that they have laws that protect them and not laws that prevent them from seeking help if they need it. And can you repeat the question? Because I feel like I only answered part of that.
Yeah, really just when it comes to looking at the intersections between sex work and health, like what parts of the situation could be improved through further public awareness, or like it feels like there's a real taboo about even just talking about sex work out in the open on the FM radio. So what is the way to do that in a way that is going to have a like a net positive impact on society, whether that's the people who engage in sex work or the people who don't engage in sex work, but maybe they vote for people who make laws that regulate sex work?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think a good starting point, I will often have conversations with people who are like, oh, like, I just don't know how I feel about it. There seems to be a lot of moral panic around sex work, or people have a lot of moral attachments to the idea of sex work. And I think a good way to first broach it is by looking at like, well, do you not think that sex workers deserve rights? And kind of turning it away from the idea of whether or not it's morally okay to like engage in sex work, to if they're going to engage in it, do you not think that they should be doing it in safe working conditions? Do you not think that they should have rights? If you're worried about them, then like, let's provide them with the resources that they need. It's just really interesting because it is, you know, one of these type of work that people have a lot of feelings about. Sex is something I think in our society that people don't like to talk about, or that they have shame about, or they have particular feelings about. And that can be cultural, that could be have religious influences, that can have be based in personal experience or whatever it might be. But I think that we live in a society where sex is something that we don't talk about publicly generally. So then when you intersect that with work, it becomes that much more taboo. So I think the easiest, and I think there's a long way we can come in terms of a society, in terms of being open about that and whatever that may look like. But when you're thinking about social determinants of health, when you're thinking about health services, it's kind of the same as like harm reduction or substance use. You may not do substances yourself. You may not have an interest in drug use, but do we all agree that these people deserve to live? Do we all agree these people deserve to have rights and access to healthcare and supports? Yes, like I think that that's a pretty simple place to start, and it's a rights-based place to start. Do these people have a right to exist? Do they have a right to have access to laws and workplace safety measures?
Lee Ray Ray, thank you very much for taking
Lee
the time.
Lee Ray Ray,
thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lee and Ray Ray are involved with Peers Victoria Resources Society, an organization supporting sex workers in the capital region. We were talking in part about a program they offer, which gives support to migrant and immigrant sex workers in Victoria.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
The Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction has put together a guide to help leaders in small cities address substance use related harms. The Small Cities Playbook for Action provides examples of more than 50 different interventions intended to address substance use harms from different angles, including prevention, harm reduction, treatment, housing supports, and policing-related interventions. The playbook is accompanied by an implementation guide to offer community leaders a pathway to identify what might work in their specific communities. I spoke with a member of the team behind the guide about how they came up with this roadmap for smaller cities.
My name is Chandni Sandagar. I'm a senior knowledge broker with the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction. For those of you listening who might not be familiar with who we are, commonly called CCSA, we are an NGO, a non-governmental organization that was created by an act of parliament to provide leadership on issues related to substance use.
And this year you have come out with a playbook for action for small cities dealing with the substance use crisis. Maybe just to get started in this context, what does small city mean?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. And it was something that we even kind of discussed at our organization of how we were going to define small cities. So for the purpose of our initiative, the Small Cities Initiative, we actually define small cities as communities of having population about 150,000 or less, to really create like a geographical map and population map of what that community would look like.
And you're talking about Canada's substance use crisis. In the context of this strategy, what does that mean? Help me understand the term substance use crisis.
Yeah, happy to do so. So when we think about substance use crisis, we have to recognize that this is an incredibly complex issue when we think about the challenges that the country is facing, but the communities themselves, right? So we think about the rising overdose deaths that we're seeing across the country, the increase in public consumption, as well as the emergence of encampments, as well as the evolving and unpredictable drug supply that continues to shift and change, and the implications that this is truly having in communities, but across the country, and the infrastructural strains that this is having. But we also have to recognize that substance use itself doesn't exist in a vacuum. This, in fact, intersects with a number of other crises. So we think about housing, we think about homelessness, we think about public safety, community safety. We also think about mental health as well as chronic pain. So there's a number of challenges that intersect when we think about the substance use crisis that Canada is facing.
And you've talked about this idea of risk and protective factors as far as both like on the individual level and on the community level of how likely someone is to experience substance use harms. Could you talk to me about that idea of like risk and protective factors and what they look like in small cities?
Yes, absolutely. So when we're talking about risk and protective factors, we're talking about a couple of things here. So risk factors are things that can increase an individual or a community's risk to experiencing harms and in relation to substance use, harms related to substance use. And protective factors are those things that can help to protect against those harms. So when you think about an individual, right, we're thinking about the risk factors that could really increase their risk for developing a substance use disorder or even mental health harms or substance-related harms in general. So these could be things like trauma, thinking about adverse childhood experiences, social pressures, as well as just disease and biological predispositions. And then when we think about those protective factors for those individuals, we think about what are those pieces or factors that an individual can benefit from in order to reduce those kinds of risks. So these could be things like having a supporting of a family and friend network. It could be having positive coping skills. It could be including being able to develop those resiliency skills as well when it comes to responding to some of these challenges that might be inflicted because of trauma or through adverse childhood events. And we think about this from the course of a community, we think about this as a whole, right? So we think about the structure that the community falls within and that ecosystem that exists in. So we think about how easy is it for communities or members of those communities to be able to actually access services across the continuum of care, right? What are employment opportunities? Are there employment opportunities? What do those look like? When we think about youth in our community, those are things like after school programs or different activities that engage them. And then we think about those protective factors, right? We want to identify things that allow them to have those access to those services that allow them to truly be able to hone in and be able to build those resilient skills. And then when you think about those risk factors, right? Like how accessible are substances for communities? Are there employment opportunities? So those are some of the things that we think about when we think about for a community as a whole.
And what are some of the things that you're recommending communities can do to take action and try and address some of the harms that could be impacting people related to substance use?
Yeah, and so that's a great question. And I think what I want to begin with is that when we're trying to deal with something so complex like substance-related challenges and the intersections that it falls within other crises, it's really important to understand that it's not going to be a single solution that's going to solve this crisis. And that is why we've developed the Playbook for Action, right? This resource has really been developed to better help communities understand what are evidence-based approaches they could be considering for implementation for their communities, recognizing that each community experiences unique challenges, whether that's through the design of their infrastructure, whether that is through the challenges that they have in terms of accessing services, the geographical differences, especially if you are a region that could be quite sparse but have all your services locally in a central hub, or maybe you're a community that doesn't have services but needs to lean into other communities or neighboring communities to be able to access those services. So I wouldn't say that there is one single solution to this. I think it's really important to be able to understand what are the unique challenges a community is facing, what are the kinds of assets a community already has, and how can that be bolstered, and what are other areas that there are gaps that could be filled. And the Playbook for Action has over 50 evidence-based interventions that a community could draw from and then consider to adapt and include for implementation within their communities.
Now, a lot of the higher level things that could be done to address some of the harms for what is essentially a health issue are fall under the purview of the provincial government, the federal government, governments that have a lot more resources perhaps to deal with some of these issues. When it comes to making a playbook for municipalities themselves to try and lead on these, how do you balance the fact that they're going to have somewhat limited resources and maybe things like healthcare aren't really viewed as traditionally in their purview?
No, and that's a fantastic question, right? And it's absolutely true. Like when we think about health, it doesn't fall within the purview of municipalities. That largely sits within the provinces. But with that being said, that doesn't mean that municipalities are powerless. They have a number of levers that they could be leaning on. So when we think about what it is that communities can do and what municipalities can do, it's things like developing a community safety and well-being plan, for example, or developing a substance use response strategy. There are also a number of other things that municipalities can be doing to support a response. This could also be things like offering community spaces to organizations that offer different services or social services and health supports, being able to bring together partners. Municipalities are incredibly tangible in being able to and resource to be able to bring together different sectors and bring together partners to have conversations and really promote this level of cross-sectoral collaboration, as well as to promote this more coordinated response. And other things that I think about is just even advocating. So municipalities can really be able to lean in on that and being able to advocate for what their community needs are, working with and alongside the provinces and federally, as well as other organizations and sectors that exist within their communities.
Could you walk me through maybe what some concrete examples of what you just described could look like in terms of a municipality's ability to bring together different players in the community? What kinds of groups could they be bringing together and to do what?
Yeah, no, and that's a fantastic question. So when we think about this cross-sectoral collaboration, right, I think it's important to think about what kind of resources we have in the community and the challenges that community is trying to address. So I want to reflect on a community that we've been having some great conversations with in Ontario, and they've been having to really trying to better understand what they could be doing to support and respond to the challenges around housing and chronic homelessness in their community. So it was really interesting to see how this municipality were able to bring in different sectors. So that included the private sector, that were folks that were builders and developers within their community. They also brought in religious groups. They also brought in different community organizations, community-based organizations that support housing. And what they were able to do was develop collectively a strategy for what a response would look like, but also investment for the community. And as a result of the work that they've done, they're now actually on track to eliminating chronic homelessness by 2027. So this is an example of what it could look like when you bring together different sectors and bring together folks around a shared vision for a more coordinated response.
What municipality is that you're talking about in Ontario?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share. So this is St. Thomas. It's a small municipality in Ontario.
Near London for folks, right?
That's correct.
How would you respond to a reluctance from municipal leaders? It's something I've certainly heard the mayor talk about during council meetings in Nanaimo, a reluctance to commit to significant intervention that would require spending a lot of municipal funds on things that they feel like are the provincial government's job to do, with a fear that the provincial government would say, hey, they're spending money on this, they've decided that they're going to take control of this, and we're going to spend our money elsewhere, maybe.
Yeah, so these are things that we've heard from a number of municipalities. So I think the challenge really becomes and really understanding what is within the purview of municipalities, what is within the purview of the provinces, but also understanding where is that handover and where is that alignment. And often what we've seen is that some of these communities can be working in silos with their provinces, right? And being able to truly be able to paint and define what is within the purview of municipalities, but also where those levers that can be pulled. And if it is in fact a provincial issue or if it's a municipal issue, how can we be working more collaboratively together? So it's a very tricky question in the sense of it's a challenge that I think a lot of communities are facing and really trying to understand how we can create this more collective response and collaboration.
In the Small Cities Playbook, you also introduce this idea of substance use health. And really, what I took away from that, it's the idea of thinking more about substance use health as more of a continuum as opposed to like a light switch where there's a problem or not. I'm wondering if you can tell me about that in this context.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we speak of substance use health, and I do want to note that this was a term that was actually developed by CAPSA and introduced by CAPSA. And what it really describes is the idea that we all exist on this continuum, right? And our experiences with substance use also exist on this continuum between no use, as well as recognizing that there are risks and benefits to substance use as we progress in our use or move between our different uses. And it also recognizes that when we think about substance use health, that folks can actually be moving across along the continuum at different points in their life. And this can actually vary from substance to substance.
This is People First Radio. I'm speaking with Chandni Sondagar. She's a senior knowledge broker with the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction. Right now, we're talking about the organization's Playbook for Action, a document that contains a number of interventions small cities could implement to address substance use-related harms from a number of different angles, including harm reduction, prevention, treatment, housing supports, and policing-related interventions. And you also mention in the playbook that poorly managed pain is a key driver of substance use in Canada, and that people living with chronic pain, especially in smaller communities, can feel unsupported or left with few alternatives to opioid use. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little more about that idea.
Yeah, so we know that pain, and especially chronic pain that goes uncared for, can be incredibly challenging for those individuals who are suffering from this. And this becomes quite complex because folks are turning to substances that can allow them to experience like a relief from that level of pain. So when we think about the complexity of this and the work that happens in this field, we think about the implications that this has, right? It communities, and especially those individuals that don't feel like that they're getting access to the services that they need or the supports they need, are at higher risk of developing substance use disorders or experiencing other challenges. And it becomes quite complex when we think about that relationship. So I think what's important is that when we think about why people are using substances, to really be able to tailor our responses and supports and the types of services we offer in a way that truly meets them, their needs.
And in the playbook, you have broken up the interventions into six different categories, and each category has a number of different interventions that a municipality could look at implementing. How do you think you would frame this to someone who maybe looks at the list and says, wow, there's a lot there. If my community isn't already doing a bunch of these things, it could seem like intimidating to know how to prioritize which of these things to prioritize, and the idea of like being able to do them all, or even to do a broad swath of them from all the different sections. It seems like a lot. How would you recommend someone who works in a municipality or who's a municipal leader who's been tasked with addressing substance use harms start to tackle the problem on one of the any one or all of these six areas?
So when you look at the playbook, like you said, there are six large buckets or categories in which these interventions fall under. And we did that so because we wanted to really demonstrate the broad nature and the spectrum in which interventions can lie. And so what you'll see in the playbook is we have interventions that are far upstream, thinking about like upstream health, thinking about health promotion, education, harm reduction, treatment, recovery. And I do also want to recognize that, again, we know that substance use is quite complex. It doesn't exist in a vacuum and intersects with a number of other crises. So you'll see that there are other categories in here that really allow folks to be able to see that. Where we have categories around housing and employment, public safety, as well as community and cultural supports. So to answer your question, yes, absolutely. This is incredibly overwhelming when you look at this list of over 50 interventions. So where I'd recommend a community start is actually with our implementation guide. So the implementation guide is a companion resource that we developed that really sits with the playbook for action. And it essentially walks communities through this step-by-step process of understanding how they would go about identifying based on what their community needs are, doing a community needs assessment, understanding what their local challenges are, what kind of assets and resources that they have, and what their priorities are, to then determine which of the interventions from this playbook their community could consider for implementation. And like you were saying, some communities might already be doing some of this, but it could also then prompt conversations about, is this truly meeting our needs? Is where are the gaps? Can things be bolstered? What is working and what isn't working?
What kind of a response have you had from different small municipalities in Canada to the guide? Are folks using this? Have you seen it make a difference so far?
Yeah, no, so we were quite thrilled that this has been 2 years in the making in terms of the Small Cities Initiative. And we have just recently launched the playbook and implementation guide only a couple of months ago. But even then, we still have been having conversations with a number of municipalities. It's been received really positively. People see this as a tangible resource that they can turn to that's grounded in evidence to provide guidance and support the conversations that they're having in communities. In terms of some of the communities that we've engaged with, I'd like to talk about one community in particular in Ontario, where West Nipissing, where they're actually having conversations about how they can be taking the playbook for action and integrated in their next update of their community well-being and safety planning. We also are chatting with communities that are recently been funded to look at the Icelandic prevention model and have gone through the process of actually assessing their community data and are now at the point of understanding, like, okay, what can we do now? What are our options? And are now turning to the playbook to determine what are some of those interventions that they could be considering for implementation.
We're coming up to municipal elections here in BC in just a couple of months. What would you suggest is the role for people interested in running for their local city council in their smaller city or even the mayor? What do you think this resource can do for them? How do you think councillors and mayors and prospective councillors and mayors can use this?
Yeah, so when I think about what this playbook is really meant to be, right, it's really meant to be this tangible tool that communities can use. We recognize that, municipalities aren't necessarily experts when it comes to substance use health, but this tool really can help them arm to have some of those conversations with their communities and with their constituents around the real challenges that these communities are faced with, and as well as approaches that their communities could be considering, and being able to really start that dialogue and conversation to be able to determine what could a response look like and understand where are those community needs.
How were you going to evaluate success for this resource a couple of years down the road?
That is a great question because we are currently in that process now. So now that we've launched both the resources, our team has been really working to think about what does success look like for us. And for us, really in the short term, is actually seeing folks using this resource. And what we also recognize is that it's all well and good to have both these resources, but the other piece of this that we need to continue to build on is how folks can actually tangibly put this into practice. So a lot of the work that we're going to be focusing on in the next year or so is identifying ways that we can create the conditions that would allow communities to be able to be successful in actually implementing this and putting it into practice for those that want to do this work. So some of the things that we're actually going to be putting together is a coaching network where we're putting together, bringing together subject matter experts from across the country that have experience in actually implementing interventions from the playbook, who can now be really a source of resource, as a mentor, as a coach, to help communities walk through the process of actually implementing the interventions, but also navigating the political climate, right? It can be quite challenging, and being able to have someone who can walk you through that process. And as part of this work, we're also looking and have developed education and training through our National Learning Center, where we're trying to really support communities to better understand what substance use health is, explore different substance-related topics, as well as bring to light different interventions and programs that are being implemented across the country.
Is there anything else you think it's important to let people know about the playbook?
When I think about the playbook and implementation guide, this really is meant to be a tool and a resource. And I think about the role that municipalities can play, right? This is a complex issue that municipalities are truly on the front lines for. But what I really want to reiterate is that communities aren't powerless. There are levers that they can be pulling on, and the playbook and guide can be a great resource as they embark on their process to understand what a response looks like. And here at CCSA, we're more than happy to support. So if communities do want to learn more, I do encourage you to reach out to us. We'd be more than happy to have a conversation to see what we could do to support your community.
Well, Chandni, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Chandni Sondagar is a senior knowledge broker with the Canadian Centre on Substance Use and Addiction. We were talking about the organization's Playbook for Action, a document containing a number of interventions small cities could implement to address various substance use related harms. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.